Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, Le Chablais.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints on this week's show. The bishop representing the region of Cape Breton gives his blessing to new Pope Leon XIV.
This pope was born in the U.S., but most of his time was spent away from the United States. He's the least of the American cardinals.
Community consultations are being held over the growing number of cannabis greenhouses on Six Nations.
We want you to know that this council hears the concerns that are being brought to our attention. Know that structured meetings with the Cannabis Commission will continue. Also, community consultation is being planned.
June is Stroke and Aphasia Awareness Month. Loyalist Township opts in.
We have over 108,000 new strokes in Canada annually, with over 800,000 Canadians living with the effects of stroke, and stroke does happen every 5 minutes in Canada.
3,000 blankets and counting have been made by the Knitting for Warmth group in Minden, Ontario.
I did not expect the volume of it. A blanket does represent warmth and, to me, caring now.
It's just very rewarding to be able to give back to the community. It's fun. I love coming here.
The Sackville Food Bank president received a coronation medal recognizing strong leadership and compassion. And to Fredericton, New Brunswick, where the Tokyo Ramen fast food restaurant just reopened. Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Welcome to you all. My name is Boris Chassai, and I'll be with you for the next half hour with the help of our journalists posted in New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Ontario this week. We first turn out east to Glace Bay, where Bishop Wayne Kirkpatrick in Indigenish applauded the Vatican's choice for the new pope. He said he was surprised by the Vatican's decision, first because Leo XIV, at 69 years old, is considered young for a pontiff, also because he's American. Kirkpatrick says both details are untraditional, but he adds Leo's commitment to focus on the underprivileged makes him a wise choice. He says the Pope has spent much of his religious career outside of the States, citing the two decades he spent in Peru. The last Pope to take the name of Leo was an Italian in the late 1800s. Details with Bill McCouch in Glace Bay, Nova Scotia.
The bishop representing the Catholic Church in Cape Breton supports the Vatican's choice for the new Pope. Wayne Kirkpatrick of the Diocese of Antigonish says Robert Prevost, Pope Leo XIV, is well equipped to lead the Church, although he tells Coast Radio he is surprised that 69-year-old American bishop was endorsed by his peers.
I thought those two things might go against him, but everything else qualified him to be the pope as far as I was concerned. And I knew that he was, although a U.S. citizen, he spent most of his ministry in South America. And he's a member of religious order, Augustinian, and he'd been their superior general for a time. So he had a worldview. He was a pastor, first and foremost, and a good shepherd to the people in his diocese there in Peru.
Kirkpatrick says Vatican tradition usually results in the election of a pope older than Leo, so that a fresh perspective comes sooner rather than later, although there are some exceptions.
Pope John Paul II was like 57, so he died, I think he was 82, so that meant he was pope all that time. And typically, they don't necessarily want somebody who's going to be pope too long. If it's not, he was not a good pope, or, you know, whatever. So you don't really appoint or elect somebody who's going to be around forever. Normally, you would appoint someone who'll be there for a period of time. But in this case, it was, well, he's the best candidate for this time period and the way the world is.
Since President Donald Trump took office, the U.S. has been at odds with many countries around the world over international matters, including tariffs. Kirkpatrick says Leo is outspoken for some issues and believes the pontiff will care for those who are less fortunate.
His records show that he was not supportive of President Trump's deportation of immigrants. And he's on record as having said that. I expect him to have the same, along the same vein as Pope Francis, humble surroundings. He's a religious priest who's taken a vow of poverty And I'm sure he'll live that vow even as Pope Francis did.
Kirkpatrick says for those who are discouraged that Leo is American, it should be made clear he is influenced beyond the borders of the U.S.
This Pope was born in the U.S., grew up there, but most of his time was spent away from the United States. And as some Italian cardinals or whatever news media said, he's the least of the American cardinals because he doesn't follow in their footsteps and what we're presumed to be, you know, a mindset of the United States. He has a more of a mindset of South America. In fact, that's why his opening words, you know, he spoke in Italian, then he spoke in Spanish, relating back to the people of his diocese in Peru. He did not speak in English, and I think that's significant.
Over the past few decades, the Catholic Church has been rocked by sex scandals involving members of the clergy. Kirkpatrick believes Leo has the vision and wisdom to improve the Vatican's image in many ways, including the way they appoint the bishops.
Well, I mean, first of all, Pope Leo has a doctoral degree in canon law. He studied in Rome, and he worked in Rome for a number of years prior to being appointed as the prefect for the Congregation for Bishops. And as a prefect, they'd be looking for new bishops and what they want to see in new bishops. So I would think that he would be keenly aware of what he would expect out of a bishop, what he's looking for, someone to be appointed as a bishop. And I believe that he will be upholding the church's teaching with regard to abuse. It's not tolerated.
An Italian cardinal priest took the same name as Pope in the late 1800s, Leo XIII. Vatican watchers say Robert Prevost's decision to name himself Leo is significant, given the former's legacy of social justice and reform. Pope Francis died at the age of 88 on April 21st. For the Local Journalism Initiative, Bill McCush.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
Six Nations community members are sharing concerns over the amount of cannabis greenhouses that have or are being built within the community. They also have other safety and health concerns surrounding their operations. Six Nations Chief Sherilyn Hill says the council has heard the community's call for consultation on the issue. Andrew Dow in Oshawa, Ontario.
Six Nations elected council have responded to community concerns over the number of cannabis greenhouses that have been constructed on the territory and say community engagement opportunities for community members to voice their concerns will be happening. Six Nations elected chief Sherilyn Hill addressed the issue during the May 13th general council meeting.
So I'd like to share some comments about the number of greenhouses being constructed in the community. We want you to know that this council hears the concerns that are being brought to our attention. We are concerned for the continued safety of all. We confirmed during our meeting with the Cannabis Commission last week that a site of interest on Fourth Line was indeed issued a license to grow cannabis. We learned they will be growing within a contained environment, greenhouses instead of field production. Know that structured meetings with the Cannabis Commission will continue. Also, community consultation regarding the Six Nations cannabis law and regulation is being planned so community can share their views, concerns, and opinions. More information will be shared as it is available.
In recent weeks, concerns from community members had been shared on Facebook about the operations of a cannabis greenhouse called Legacy Farms located on Fourth Line Road, just outside the village of Oswegan, with some of the concerns coming from Facebook involving non-band member employees of Legacy Farms residing and living on the greenhouse property, which would be in violation of the Six Nations residency bylaw that states only Six Nations band members can reside within the territory. In a May 1st media release from Six Nations Cannabis Commission, it stated that Legacy Farms is a licensed cannabis facility with the commission, and the commission stated they have, quote, conducted a thorough inspection of the premises and can confirm that there are no non-band members residing on the property. The facility does not have any living quarters. However, employees who work 12-hour shifts have access to cooking and shower facilities, end quote. No further timeline was given for when a community consultation meeting will take place, but Six Nations elected council say more updates will be provided when they become available. I'm Andrew Dow, and this news story is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, which supports the creation of original civic journalism.
We stay in Ontario, where the Loyalist Township has proclaimed the month of June as Stroke and Aphasia Awareness Month. This following a suggestion made by the Greater Kingston Victorian Order of Nurses, VON, who approached Township Council with a proclamation request this week. The VON's Stroke Service Programs offer free non-medical support to individuals and families affected by stroke and aphasia. More on this with Ted Evans in Stella, Ontario.
Loyalist Township is proclaiming June as Stroke and Aphasia Awareness Month. The Greater Kingston Victorian Order of Nurses approached Township Council with a proclamation request at their meeting this week. The organization offers community support programs for seniors and persons with disabilities. Their stroke services programs offer free non-medical support to individuals and families affected by stroke and aphasia. There are monthly groups held in Sydenham, Kingston, and Napanee. Social worker and coordinator of stroke services with the Greater Kingston Victorian Order of Nurses, Amelia Leslie, notes the importance of awareness, highlighting statistics in Canada.
We have over 108,000 new strokes in Canada annually, with over 800,000 Canadians living with the effects of stroke, and stroke does happen every 5 minutes in Canada.
The organization encourages community members to recognize the warning signs of a stroke and to immediately call 911. They're also encouraging people to learn about aphasia and how to promote accessible communication. Leslie explains the medical conditions.
Stroke being a neurological condition affecting the disruption of blood flow in the brain. And because the brains are control center of everything, anything can be affected. When we talk about aphasia, it's a language and communication disorder affecting our ability to read or write or produce speech or understand speech, but not affecting our intelligence.
Leslie mentions the need for communication accessibility and the awareness of it as well.
We're often teaching the community about what's called accessible communication strategies. We think about accessibility as far as physical space, maybe having a ramp or an automatic door button, but we are also teaching folks about the communication accessibility.
Leslie notes the importance of Stroke and Aphasia Awareness Month in all communities.
We work all year to raise awareness about these neurological conditions. And June is Stroke and Aphasia Awareness Month in Canada. So we're especially inviting our communities to learn what stroke and aphasia are and how to help.
I'm Ted Evans.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
So for the past 23 years, the Knitting for Warmth group in Minden, Ontario, has gathered every Tuesday afternoon to stitch together blankets for those who need them most. This group of friends has gathered each week to knit or crochet squares into gorgeous blankets that are then donated. So far, 3,000 blankets have been knitted and donated. The idea came from Mary Trepanier. She's now a project manager of Knitting for Warmth. She never expected that her simple idea of gathering to knit each week would turn into the popular mission it is today. In Haliburton, Ontario, here's Elizabeth Oakley.
I don't knit. I crochet.
Okay.
So what we do here is we're stitching the squares together that somebody else has knitted.
One square at a time. That's how the Women of Knitting for Warmth, a volunteer-run group of talented women, show their care for their community with every row they knit or crochet. Minden's own Knitting for Warmth is about helping others who need the comfort these ladies provide in the form of beautiful handmade blankets. Every one of them begins with a single 8x8-inch square, then they're stitched together. The warm blankets are for those who need them the most. 23 years ago, Mary Trepanier never imagined her dream to form a small knitting circle would grow into what it is today. With the help of so many others, she says the blankets are the tangible way to show they care.
I did not expect the volume of it. I thought a couple times a year, like I'd save up the squares until I could do some so-so blankets, and then I'd ask people to come and I'd serve them tea and coffee and goodies and we'd put some blankets together. These are the volunteers, the knitters and the crocheters. They made it happen. I just suggested it and the rest of the community went with it. A blanket does represent warmth and, to me, caring now.
Recently, the Women of Knitting for Warmth celebrated the completion of their 3,000th blanket. When finished, the blankets are donated to a variety of organizations, including the Minden Food Bank, Search Special Delivery, A Place Called Home, Point in Time, Highland Crest Extended Care, Kawartha Halliburton Children's Aid Society, and the Ronald McDonald House. The ladies make an assortment of blankets, including lap blankets for those in wheelchairs, baby blankets, and those that are regular size. And it seems knitters always seem to find the group one way or another. There are seniors from care homes in the GTA knitting squares, and even cottagers who contribute squares as well.
The knitting seemed to be the thing. I have had women who have said my mother's early Alzheimer's or agitated, just not restful, how do I keep her busy? And they might forget a lot of things, but not how to knit. And it's just straight knitting, knit front, knit back. That first advertisement, I did it in the summer, and that's the cottagers were here. And I also know that this has got a lot of senior citizens here, so they're knitters here. Or crocheters, don't let me forget that. Crochet is just fine too. So they sat on the end of the dock, they knit a square. Their neighbor said, what are you doing? And then they all went back to the city in the fall. And I gave them a thank you note. I said, stick it on your fridge. I only send a thank you note the first time you send me stuff. They went back to their cities and told their friends. And so I get boxes of them left on my porch in the spring, and I get boxes left in the fall.
Wendy Rohanich has been knitting since she was a little girl. She lives in Oshawa and has a cottage in the Minden area. She's been part of the group for 2 years, and while she has the longest drive, she tries hard not to miss her Tuesday sessions with her newfound friends and fellow knitters.
It's just very rewarding to be able to give back to the community, like to be able to just get together and sew squares and give it back. It's fun. I love coming here. I miss it. I didn't come last week. I missed it. Yeah, it's just rewarding. These ladies are lovely.
For Darlene Ewell, being able to get out and enjoy the friendship of her fellow knitters is what keeps her coming back. She says going through the COVID pandemic without her friends was a dark time.
We couldn't come. It was. I missed it terribly because it's part of my therapy to come and talk to people and be with them and make things that are going to be sent all over. I'm slowing up a lot, you know. But I would come here anyway, even if I couldn't do squares just for Mary's stories, I'd still come.
Thanks to Elizabeth Oakley in Halliburton, Ontario. Sackville Food Bank President Heather Patterson is the latest area resident to be honored with the King Charles III Coronation Medal. In February, 12 different residents of Tantramar, Strait Shores, and Memramcook also received a medal in a ceremony hosted by Beau Séjour Federal MP Dominique Leblanc. And a couple of months later, Sackville Food Bank Executive Director Heather Patterson got hers. Erica Butler in Sackville stopped by the Sackville Food Bank this week and asked Patterson about her history helping feed the region's families.
I started here in 2015 just as a volunteer, and then 2 years later I took on the presidency, and we've changed enormously in that time, partly because of increased pressure by rising food insecurity. We had a little dip during COVID, but we've gone back up and we've almost doubled what we used to do. Like a really good, no, a really busy day for us would have been 55 people before COVID. Now it's typically up in the 80 range. And 55 was really exceptional. We never had, almost never had that many normally. So things have changed, and we've expanded our facility as well. We just got a new addition, which is very exciting because it's a cold room. It means that we have more room to supply, to store and supply produce for our folks who come. And so we've also gotten a number of grants to buy new things. And one of them is a really big display freezer, which we had a real challenge getting in here. So that was exciting. We got that from a grant. With a lot of grant application writing and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I mean, most people think of food banks, they think dry goods. But I mean, in this cold room in here, I can see big flats of eggplant in there. So you're definitely, you're providing, and you've got freezers. So you're providing fresh and frozen food as well.
Yes. A lot. Yeah. Every week we get fresh food from the Food Depot La Monterre, but we also get it from another source. And then in the summertime, we have gardeners and farmers come in with fresh produce. So we always have something in the way of fresh produce. Like our standard is onions, carrots, and potatoes. Those are standard. But then we get into other vegetables, which are maybe a little more delicate. And so we can only keep them for a while. But yeah, we always have fresh or frozen meat. We buy eggs now from the eggs plant in Amherst. And we supply cheese and milk always.
Has the demand since, you know, you had that spike after COVID, right? I mean, during COVID, I think there was less demand because of the CERB.
Yes.
But then once the CERB was gone, demand went up. Is it still as high? Has it remained?
Yeah, it has. It's gone steadily up. Every week almost we get new clients. Now, a lot of the clients, when they first move here, they come to the food bank and then they don't need us anymore once they get settled into their job and into their home. But our numbers are really high. And it just seems so wrong. And, you know, one of the things that struck me about COVID is CERB kind of proved that it works. Guaranteed annual income works, right? There's less food insecurity, less family violence, greater school achievement. Every study that they've done has proved that a guaranteed annual income really works. And Canada, I think, is ready for that kind of thing.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that would maybe put you out of a job here.
That's exactly what we want. I'm the only, I work in the only sector of the economy, I think, that is looking to put itself out of business. We don't want to grow. We want to shrink, if not just go away altogether. I mean, there might always be people who just can't make it on their own, and that's fine. But there should be other ways of keeping people fed and secure. Because food insecurity isn't just you go hungry. It's really hard psychologically to think that you can't put food on the table for your child or for your family. And it just, you're constantly worried, wondering where the next, you know, how you're going to pay your bills, that kind of thing. And it is actually a vicious cycle because you're so anxious. Often people develop psychological problems and then they can't work. So then they're more dependent on us. So it's a really, food insecurity is really bad in so many ways.
Back to your medal now. Yes. I mean, it must have been quite an honor to be recognized for your work as a volunteer and the hours you've put in. I wonder if it's, you know, speaks to something that so many people in the food security, like, you know, that there is this cohort of food security people being recognized with these medals.
Yeah, it was a real surprise. I had no idea where it came from. And the Food Depot La Monterre are the people who nominated me, which is really nice because I sort of expect it of people that I work with. They understand the hours I put in, but I didn't know they knew, right? So that was kind of exciting. And then to be there in Moncton getting the medal with all these other people who work all towards the same goal, basically to put ourselves out of business, but to keep our families fed. And it's pretty wonderful.
That's Heather Patterson, Executive Director of the Sackville Food Bank, who has just received the King Charles III Coronation Medal in recognition of her contribution to her community. This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints.
And to close the show, a heartwarming story about the Kamazuka family who had to close their Tokyo Ramen restaurant in Fredericton after their head chef and father fell suddenly ill. The Fredericton family-run restaurant had to close when head chef Hirofumi Kamazuka fell ill, and ill he was after consulting health authorities while traveling to Japan. Hirofumi was told that one day could have made a difference between life and death. So after resting and recovering for 10 months, Hirofumi is back in the Tokyo Ramen kitchen, but not working 13-hour shifts like he used to. The family did not know what to expect when they reopened on May 1st after a 10-month absence, but their announcement on Facebook received over 50,000 views in less than a week, almost as much as Fredericton's total population. Aiden Keenan in Fredericton, New Brunswick.
Located just outside Fredericton's downtown, in the quieter Skyline Acres neighborhood, Tokyo Ramen is a family affair, run by the Kamazukas, who are originally from Japan, but immigrated from Oregon to Fredericton around 7 years ago. Tokyo Ramen sets itself apart from similar restaurants in the city by focusing on traditional handmade food, including their noodles. The Kamazukas' attention to detail was not without consequence, as the restaurant shut down in July due to head chef Hirofumi's health complications.
My father, he was a head chef. He has a diabetes, and his conditions get very bad. Actually, prior to July, that closure, we actually closed for a little while in April beforehand, a few months beforehand, just because our grandparent had a difficulty situation, so we quickly want to visit them. And while there, we also checked in with the hospital, see if everything is okay. And apparently my father was on the verge of death because his kidney wasn't properly functioning. He had a strong loss of appetite. He worked 13 hours a day, and yet he doesn't eat anything, and we were too concerned about it. So the doctor said, if he's not taking the dialysis treatment today, you're not going to see him tomorrow.
Hirofumi's health had declined so severely that he was not eligible for a kidney transplant, and has instead spent the past year resting and receiving dialysis treatments. Although, as of the reopening, he's back in the kitchen.
My father, although he's getting better, we're not going to make him work 13 hours a day. So we don't want just randomly hire people. We have to make sure that, again, the food quality is consistent. So we have to be very selective on the people who works here, who's not going to be working here.
Fumi explained how that intensive work environment leads to strong bonds between past and current employees.
We make sure not just the customers, but also the staff member that we work together are treated well. Some people in our restaurant just came back from long-term closure. They're not employee, but they used to. They just start washing dishes. They're like, stop doing that. But they're like, oh, it's okay. I got some time. Those things, really happy to see that the staff member that we're working together is just a pleasure to just work with the people who's kind and genuine.
Fumi emphasized that an inviting and homey atmosphere is key to his family's vision for the restaurant, a sentiment echoed by customers.
The lighting, the coziness, everyone's really friendly. You walk in, everyone says hi, you leave, everyone says bye. I don't know, it's just, it's humbling, it's warming.
Finally, Fumi explained that he and his family were concerned about reopening after such a long hiatus.
Our hope was pretty low in the beginning, because we thought when we're in Japan, when we go back into Canada and to Fredericton to reopen the restaurant, I'm sure there's going to be no one to visit us, because a restaurant doesn't close this long for this urgently. But as when we got a lot of welcomes from the comments on Facebook, we got about the 50,000 view within a few days. We got our strength back, and we're very happy that we chose this place to work.
I'm Aiden Keenan for Local Journalism Initiative.
And that's all for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our LJI journalist Andrew Dow, Ted Evans, Bill Nakush, Elizabeth Oakley, Aiden Keenan, and Erica Butler. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. The Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for having us this week, and until the next, ciao.